to be active is nothing but his desire to run away from himself. Yeah? Distraction. And that is, of course, that is of the pole of what saying. So that the desire for activity is natural. That there is also this pseudo-phenomenon that someone tries to act in order to run away from himself. You know, that truly exists, but that is not the fundamental phenomenon, that's the misuse of it. I have to stop in 2 minutes because I have to see the station, I'm sorry. But let me see. Paragraph 67 to 68. The paragraph 68 is sufficient.
Hence it results to find two such things desirable for their own sake. One class consists of those things which constitute the ultimate good for them, namely good to mind or body. A latter class which has similar, that is, good to belong neither to your mind nor to your body, such as friends, parents, children, relatives, and one's country itself, while intrinsically practical, yet are not included in the same class as the former.
Now that is also very interesting for the question of the so-called individualism of this kind of morality. Yeah? Any other human beings are good. Yeah. That is very hard for us to understand. Yeah? But that's also more necessary to try to understand. Yeah. These are the main points, and I apologize for leaving them in the list, but I think the main point is that we have to be covered. There are so many of that, so many values of the earlier meetings that we could very well have a whole month daily meetings on Cicero, and we would not complete them. So next time we will hear Mr. Magazine. Yes? Not teachable. What is it? And the answer is recollection. This is also a riddle, but perhaps it points at least to the right direction. I will say a few words about that. Now, knowledge and wisdom are here used synonymously. So this doesn't mean, of course, the knowledge which a shoemaker has, which a physician has, which a mathematician has. This is not as the knowledge he had in mind, because we know that these partial knowledges go well together with all kinds of vices. I think we can say that without any hesitation. So, knowledge is wisdom. Why is it not teachable? Again, the most general answer is given by Solomon. No man is wise. Only God is wise. Even here in the Protagoras, in the Simonides poem discussion, comes up. Now, since no one possesses the knowledge required, no one can transmit it. No one can teach it. Now, what is the consequence of that, that no one possesses this only knowledge which deserves our ultimate respect? What follows from that? Since no one has it. Simply virtuous. Yeah, but before we come to that, no one can be simply virtuous. That's correct. And that is indicated as advice to the read the last sentence of the Bad Rapido, as well as the best and so of his contemporaries. And what follows is that one must strive for wisdom. Now, striving for wisdom, it means in the expressed in Greek, that means philosophize. Desiring to be wise, philosophize. Now, if this is so, if the highest of which man is capable is philosophizing, striving for wisdom, can this striving be taught? How can one teach striving? How can one arouse a desire? Same thing. Surely by speech, among other things. I mean, there would not be this enormous activity in Madison Avenue if one couldn't arouse desires by speech. But is arousing a desire teaching? In the case of Madison Avenue, everyone will admit that this is not teaching, but even on the highest case. Our difference is that our primary state, the state in which all of us are most of the time, in which most of us are all of the time, is from the highest point of view one of being asleep, but not without dreams. We are filled with opinion. That is our state. We need being awakened. When we awaken to the fact that many of these things are just unsupported opinions. Again, I ask the same question as before. Is awakening a man, teaching him, surely not what we ordinarily understand by teaching? At any rate, men can acquire wisdom only through striving for wisdom. Because if he doesn't acquire it, it will never be truly his own. Now, there is another point here to be considered, namely the obstacle to philosophy. According to the presentation which Socrates gives, for example, in the Republic, these obstacles are overwhelming. Let us read here a passage from the Republic, 6th book, 496. B to C. Well, just read here. Read here the beginning of this.
There is a very small remnant, then, Adeimantus, I said.
It's almost a biblical expression.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Of those who consort worthily with philosophy. Some well-born and well-bred nature, it may be, held in check by exile, and so in the absence of corruptors, remaining true to philosophy, as its quality did. Or it may happen that a great soul born in a little town scorns and disregards its parochial affairs, and a small group, perhaps, might by natural affinity be drawn to it from the other arts which they justly disdain. And the bridle of our companion Theages also might operate as a restraint. For in the case of Theages, all other conditions were at hand for his backsliding from philosophy, but his sickly habit of body keeping him out of politics holds him back. My own case, the divine sign, is hardly worth mentioning, for I suppose it has happened to few
extraordinary. Now here we have seen how these obstacles to philosophy are overcome. None of these obstacles was overcome by teaching. By something else, by Sukadeva, this daimonion, this demonic thing, that's not teaching. Theatre is the illness, is not teaching. And other kinds of fate, which seem to be important. One can enlarge this, perhaps, and say, by what happens, by things happening to men without their intending it. Bad luck or good luck. And of course, the bad luck would be blessings in disguise in this case. But still, something which we men do not call for ourselves. And this is of not sufficient whatsoever, since even if other medicines, they lead, these things may lead in given cases to a kind of conversion. And this conversion can be brought about or can be facilitated or so by an appeal. These are all not strictly speaking teachings. There is a Platonic dialogue called Theages, today regarded as spurious, I believe, by everyone except Mr. Benedetti and myself. And Benedetti's master thesis, it must be available in this Committee on Social Thought, where he wrote it, and it is worth reading it. I remember it well enough, I think. Now, here you have a young man like Hippocrates, but he is different. He comes from upstate in the first place, meaning from the rural part of the country, not from the city itself. And he is eager to learn the tyrannical art, which is of course fundamentally what Hippocrates also wants to learn. He's not given an opportunity to spell out completely what he wants to be. He says only he wants to be famous in the city, but how famous? That we do not know. And Socrates declines that, and not go into the question whether he can is a teacher of the tyrannical art or not, he has two excuses. The first is he accepts as his companions only it depends on error, whether some feeling existed in him which he cannot arbitrarily produce and which can surely not be produced by payment of money. And Theodos and his father, this rustic, thinks that it is an absolutely preposterous thing that an old man with a beard should regard himself as an erudition. And Socrates then has to give another explanation which will make an impression, and then he speaks of his daimonia, his demonic gift, and tells them absolutely terrible stories. How do you call this kind of stories? Which make people shudder.
Horror
stories about what has happened to people who have not listened to his daimonium. And then they give him. The subtlety of the dialogue is that whatever it means by arrows and what he means by daimonium is fundamentally the same. Socrates, a man unique, or almost unique, by his natural desire for philosophy, and so on. I cannot go into this. Now, but if these elements, which have nothing to do with teaching, and which cannot be brought about by teaching, does this not make philosophy utterly subjective? We hear of that very much today, and certain motives of some so-called existentialist philosophers remind, of course, of Plato. But Plato was very far from being existentialist. Now, where does reason here come in? Reasoning. It is always not too difficult to show the necessity of philosophy. meaning to show that people make assumptions which are not clear and not necessary. I mean, there may be maybe we make some assumptions which are not clear, but which are necessary. For example, that there are human beings. You see, it's very difficult. How do we know of human beings as human beings? There are all kinds of questions. But without this assumption, we cannot even begin to think. That, I would say, is a necessary assumption. And also that there are things, we cannot sensibly question that. But there are perhaps also assumptions which we make which are neither clear nor necessary. To take a simple example which some of you are quite familiar, the fact-value distinction, which plays such a great role in present-day social science, is a distinction which is neither clear nor necessary. In other words, it is always not too difficult to show that what people claim, that people claim to know, what they do not know. This is a rational thing, but this does not induce people to become concerned with knowing. This you cannot bring about. There are always great premiums on accepted opinions, which not necessarily in terms of money, maybe not about, which prevent it, and that nothing can be done about it. Nothing whatever can be done about that. This is the situation, was the situation in Plato's time, and this is the situation at all times, and no progress of science has changed that. Now, virtue is knowledge. This means for practical purposes that the virtue possible for man is not separable from philosophizing. That is, I think, the view which goes through all Platonic dialogue. And philosophizing in its turn requires a particular nature, particular attribute, which include a particular error, which we can state without this somewhat obnoxious term, too obnoxious for people today, an unquenchable desire for clarity, for the greatest possible clarity, and the greatest possible unwillingness to beat around the bush or to evade issues. And we know that this is not very frequent in the human race, this alone is an explanation. And in modern times, there is this particular complication that what was in former times not of great social power, the existence of, say, mathematics, is now a terrific thing on which the whole society has, in a sense, based modern science, which by itself doesn't have the slightest motive to raise philosophical questions, and which fosters the habit of reducing philosophy to a concern with understanding, or rather with clarifying in scientific terms what science is. This is the maximum we can expect there. All questions of concern to men are lost. So I believe we can recognize what Socrates means when he says virtue is knowledge, this enigmatic saying, as enigmatic as any saying of an oracle, and yet different from many oracular sayings, because it we can see that it makes some sense. Yes. Now there is, of course, another question, a grave question, which is very important here in the Protagoras, and as a matter of fact, everybody later. Granted that if this is so, which we cannot accept without further ado, that the only true virtue is that which accompanies philosophizing, or which follows from philosophizing. But what about the virtue of the non-philosophers, after all the largest number of human beings at all times? That is, of course, a great question. Now, Plato has a term for that, a harsh term, vulgar virtue, or, which sounds less harsh, political virtue. Political virtue meaning here the virtue of citizen. This is not genuine virtue, according to Plato. Let us never forget that the term moral virtue never occurs in Plato. It is a coinage of Aristotle. Of Aristotle. And one must be reasonable. What we mean by moral virtue, what we mean by a moral consciousness or a quality, is of course not a product of Aristotle in any way. But it is not unimportant that the term was coined so late. And of course, since that time, it was never forgotten. Morality, yes, and we in our thinking about these matters are, of course, inevitably, prior to reflection, a victim of our tradition. And this tradition is primarily, naturally, the modern tradition. When we speak of the moral conscience, i.e. that we imply somehow that what can be expected of every human being, is some simple decency. And we can elaborate that and give specimens of it, not cheating and so on, not needless pain, not murdering. We can do that very easily. But did men in former times have this notion of simple decency? In a way, of course, but how consciously, how clearly? How does the prophet say, Micah, God has told you, man, what you should do? Act justly. And walk humbly before the Lord. Now, in our notion of simple decency, the last point is not included. Obviously not. I.e., when we mean by morality, when we speak of ordinary decency, we do not count a piety as an essential part, piety meaning or sentence that we've got it, as an essential part of decency. It's very important. Where do we find that ever? I read a statement some time ago by a very good ancient historian about some late Roman writers who praised virtue, moral virtue, as the only thing which counts. And I asked him, I put the question somewhat more pointedly to him, and he never replied to me. And then I happened to meet him somewhere, he said that he wasn't there. That was the reason why he hadn't replied to me. That is very rare. I mean, this thing which grew up in the Enlightenment, modern Enlightenment, very clearly, and it was most clearly formulated by Kant, that which gives worth to any man is his goodwill, Kant called it, his sense of duty. We can say decency. And this does not in itself include anything of religion. Indirectly, yes, but not in itself. When you look at the statements of the ancient Stoics, famous for their rigorous morality, but if you look at the Stoic statements, I mean, simply take Cicero, you don't have to make very learned studies for them. What are these virtues? Of course, prudence is one of them. And when we ordinarily speak of decency, we do not today think of prudence. The modern sentimentality has taken care of that. It's the heart and not the mind. But prudence here means much more. It means theoretical knowledge. So that from the Stoic point of view, such things as logic and physics are virtues, meaning part of that overall virtue by virtue of which a man is a good man. It is very hard to find that in former times the man who would say human goodness consists in morality, i.e. in proper conduct toward other human beings, period. I wait for the man who would show me that passage. It may be there, but it surely not. But it grew up in the Enlightenment, in the context of the anti-theological implications of the Enlightenment, and is today, of the modern things, probably the most respectable part of our modern tradition. Because today people go and don't even require this decent dinner anymore. I thought that this excursus, which I didn't plan, was necessary to get clearer answers to the question. So the question with which we are concerned is to repeat, what about the virtues of the non-philosopher? When one makes such an atrocious statement as Socrates makes by saying virtue is knowledge, which means in effect the only thing which is respectable on earth is philosophizing, and its concomitant, that is clear for Socrates. A man who philosophizes cannot be a fake, he cannot be a charlatan, he cannot be a competitive, he cannot be in any way vicious. That is the gospel without the question. But what about the large majority of mankind? Now, their possible virtue is called by Plato, as I said, vulgar or political virtue. Now, Plato then does not understand by political virtue the same Protagoras, because Protagoras, as we have seen, understands political virtue in a very narrow sense, from which courage, for example, is excluded. Whereas Plato admits, as a matter of course, that there is a political courage, distinguished from true courage. At any rate, the key point, and this was then taken up by Aristotle on a very large scale, the basis of this non-philosophical virtue is habituation. You get it by being told as a child. This, you as Proclamers, described it quite nicely. Do this, don't do that. And if you do what you are told not to do, you are spanked. That is, of course, part of the habituation, and the instrument of habituation. And this clearly consists of parts. I mean, a child may be temperate, or grown up, human being for that matter, and not courageous. We all know that from the time and again. Many people who are very cowardly and very honest. So we find no difficulty in saying this. So virtue consists of parts. But of course, the question, we admit that the parts are separate, as is shown in the next example. An indication of this state of affairs we find even in Plato's Republic. I've mentioned this on a former occasion. The lowest class of men possess justice and moderation, but not courage. You remember that? Now, it would be of great interest to raise this question in order to get a full picture as within the limits of the possible now. How does Socrates' virtue look in the light of the common sense notion of virtue? I occasionally refer to a passage in Xenophon's Hero, in which Hero, the tyrant of Syracuse, to make the distinction between three kinds of men: the grave, the just, and the wise. The tyrant fears the brave because they might make a rebellion. He fears the just because they might be desired as rulers by the multitude. So the judgment would make rebellion. They don't go in for irregular action, but they would be naturally desired by, and therefore are competitors for the time. And he fears also the wise men, who are a third group category, as they say today, different from the brave and the just. And the wise he fears because they might contrive something, figure out something, you know, shrewd, cunning fellow. And now, if he applies this simple statement to Socrates, what did he do when he was subject to tyrants? Well, he surely didn't make revolt. He surely was not desired as a ruler by the multitude. He contrived more or less to survive and not to get mixed up in the horrible crimes into which the tyrants tried to get him. Now, what do we learn about this question of Socrates' virtue? Of Socrates' virtue, now we turn it around, as it were, looking not at the many in the light of the Socratic notion of virtue, but turn it around, looking at Socrates in the light of the common sense view of virtue. That would be, and I believe that we discussed the litigation scene, where we got an inkling when Socrates proceeds unjustly, yet from just. Needless to say that the final two lies are also interesting. Of course, no one except the pedant would say Socrates is a liar because he says these things, but still, it is quite remarkable that he can so easily lie. Now the Simonides scene, I believe, is the key passage as far as this question is concerned. And someone referred to it in the previous discussion, that here it is shown in agreement with Socrates' view that no man is wise, that it is shown that no man's virtue is, or goodness, is uninterrupted. Yeah? There can be all kinds of things which bring him down, all kinds of misfortune. The wise man is compelled in certain circumstances to act unwisely, or the just man is compelled to act unjustly. Goodness depends therefore on being loved by the God, or on not being conquered by chance. Now, there is only one example given of a wise man who acts badly or unjustly under compulsion, and that is Simonides himself. Being a subject of tyrants, of people whom he regards as unjust and otherwise defective, and yet he didn't keep his mouth shut only, but he praised them, which is quite a difference. You know, from our age, we know examples of, for example, from Germany, people who refrained from blaming Hitler by being subject to Hitler. It's one thing, but the people who praised Hitler, which they were not compelled to do, that's another thing. So, and Simonides did this kind of thing. An act which is unjust and cowardly, but prudent. Now, from this would imply that prudence is something different from courage and justice, as was implied in the passage of the hero, to which I refer. We can say injustice motivated by fear of tyrant, And this we must always understand in reading Plato or Xenophon, the multitude as such is such a tyrant, at least potentially, unless it is severely limited by constitutional limitations, then it is much better. This is one thing, but look at the explanation which Socrates gives of his conduct in the Gorgias. He says, if I'm accused by the city, how can I defend myself? I am the position of a physician who is accused by a cook before a tribunal of children. I never gave you candy, and I always gave you bitter pills and cut you and so on and so on. So he could not possibly tell them the truth because they would not understand it. Here there is no cowardice involved. And we know also his refusal to escape from prison, to say nothing of his conduct in war. So here we have another example where someone refrains from speaking, conceals certain things, not from fear, but because there was no alternative to it. It would be a wholly absurd action to try to explain. So then, if the question of courage doesn't arise here, one could say, accordingly, Xenophon, in his two lists of Socratic virtues, does not mention courage. But which doesn't mean that Socrates was a coward, but that virtue, that courage doesn't apply to him. Socrates went to war and was a good soldier. Which virtue did he practice in going to war? Not courage. Justice. Now what does justice mean here? Was he sure that these were just and wise actions, the Peloponnesian War, the Battle of Delion or whatever? Yeah, but more simply and directly.
The returning of
the past. No, what happens in war?
During
how do you know? But what happens in war? How comes that A is then to a campaign and B is not sent? Disregarding now dishonest actions, there are laws which determine who is to go to war and who is not. Even if you use the lot is still the legal instrument. So justice means here law abiding. So it was law abiding even if it cost his life. Then that's good enough. But then we have to raise the question, was Socrates unqualifiedly law abiding? We have it from his own mouth in the Apology of Socrates, where he is asked, or where he asks himself, what about if the Athenians make a compromise proposal? You stop philosophizing and we let you go. In other words, we make it a law, philosophizing is strictly forbidden and a capital fine. And so it is, no, I would not obey that law. So, disregarding other cases, but this is the most important case, so it is not unqualifiedly law abiding. Rightly, because no man in his senses can swear that he will obey any possible law which may be enacted. That is important. And that this is it's not identical with anarchism or with Thoreau or that matter, but it is, I think that is truly simple common sense. Everyone, I believe, can imagine laws which he would not obey. And so law binders want to, and therefore we are up. That we, the first step is that is make a distinction between justice and law binders. All right. And then we have to take some further steps, which we cannot possibly take now on better grounds, I hope, than those on which Protagoras said, now we have to turn them from here. And so let us meet next Monday for some coaching, if this is a proper term. And also perhaps try to bring the various threads, some of the threads which have not been brought together, or at least for not for a long time, finally.
We're going to...